You're listening to OWW Radio,
the official radio show of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com.
All right, so here we are, living it day by day. You are a superstar, and he says what she used to always say.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of OWW Radio. This is the official radio program of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com. Each week, OWW Radio will bring perspective to the WWE, TNA, and everything else making the news in the world of professional wrestling. My name is David, and this week I welcome Pat LaPrade and Bertrand Hebert, authors of the new book Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screwjobs, The Untold Story of How Montreal Shaped the World of Wrestling. This book is a riveting look at all the drama that unfolded in Montreal over the course of 120 years, and I'm expecting an entertaining interview. Mr. LaPrade and Mr. Hebert, welcome to OWW Radio.
Thank you for having us.
First of all, this has been an exciting time with your new publication, Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screwjobs, The Untold Story of How Montreal Shaped the World of Wrestling. Pat, how did this project get started? Whose idea was this?
I was actually the one with the idea. I was working on a ranking of the best Quebec wrestlers of all time. Mm-hmm. And while working on it, I kind of realized that, you know, we could tell more than just, you know, 20 or 25 biographies on such great wrestlers. And the idea of, you know, adding more stories to it came along. And, you know, after having started the project, Bertrand came along to help me. I knew Bertrand from the Quebec wrestling indie scene here. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, since July of 2009, we're working together on it. But, you know, the project started maybe a year before that.
Have you two written books together before?
Nope. That was the first. Actually, that's the first book we've ever written. I wrote a few magazines, like kind of an almanac, you know, recapping the year on the Quebec indie scene. You know, I did that for 4 years prior to working on the book. But before that, we never wrote a book.
But we actually did booking together.
Right. I have a family member who's also an author, and I know that it's a very long, involved, intense process. Bertrand, explain kind of how you collaboratively write a book like this together.
Well, you know, it just became, we first did some sort of a frame, if you want, of who we wanted to talk about and who we needed to talk about and what story needed to be told, like the war between Grand Prix and All-Star Wrestling. And we, from there, just split, you know, the subjects according to the time we had available at the moment. And also, we have some specialties. And so we went from there. You know, some stuff I lived through, I was there, or I knew more about from the 80s, and Pat had done a lot more research from previous eras. So we kind of split it up as we went along, just to get to our target date. But the hardest process was actually getting a publisher.
Oh, okay.
Because the book was first written in French. Because, you know, it's French is the primary language here in the province of Quebec, and so we tried and to find a French publisher at first, and I mean we tried that for over a year, and I don't know, for whatever reason, they didn't think that the publishers here didn't think that wrestling was hot enough in the province to for a book to be released on it. You know, because of that, we turned ourselves to ECW Press, and that's why the book was published in English first. And, you know, the irony of it is that maybe 3 weeks after we published our book, the book was released last February, we got a phone call from a French publisher who actually wanted to do it now. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have our French version at the end of the year. But, I mean, that was probably the hardest part of it. And I mean, me and Bertrand just, you know, even if we were, you know, writing different parts of the story, we were always, you know, reading or proofreading each other just to make sure that, you know, nothing was missed. And that, you know, all the information we wanted in the book were actually there.
Before we get into the book itself, I wanted to ask you, Bertrand, what drew you into this crazy business of professional wrestling that it became a real love for you?
I started watching wrestling about 30 years ago, and it was international wrestling on TV who turned me to the sport. And from there, I just kept on watching, and I just kept on learning. And, you know, I was a junkie. I wanted more and more and more, up until it brought me to actually working as a referee on the local scene. From there, it turned into booking, and then it turned promotion, manager. I did everything that could be done as far as that goes on the indie level. Mm-hmm. And that book just came as a logical next project. We've told on the interview here in French that we've been preparing ourselves to write that book for the past 30 years. And I think it's kind of a little bit like that, because we've been fans for about that long, and we just kept on building on that French fandom to be able to deliver that book.
Pat, same question for you. What got you interested in professional wrestling?
I watched my first live wrestling show with my dad when I was 6 years old. I'm now 36, so it's the same 30 years that Bertrand spent with, you know, as a wrestling fan. And I mean, you know, I couldn't not watch wrestling on Sunday mornings. You know, it was my mess. It was my religion, you know. And as I grew up, you know, I kept on watching, you know, with WWF and WCW. And in early 2000, I started working on the indie scene. Pretty much the same role that Bertrand had. From there, you know, I managed, I announced, I booked, I promoted, and you know, met a lot of those great wrestlers that used to draw big crowds in Montreal, you know, like Paul Leduc and Gino Brito and Raymond Rougeau and Jacques Rougeau. And, you know, so from there, you know, when we started working on the book, we already knew some of those great legends, which was, you know, a big help starting the book when we started doing interviews and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, this book is perfect for someone like myself, because my introduction to professional wrestling was during Vince McMahon's expansion in the mid-80s, and so I was able to learn an awful lot about the history of this business before the WWF takeover. You talked a little bit about some of your research methods putting this book together. In addition to your own experiences, did you conduct special interviews or go back and watch a lot of old videos, or was most of it from your own personal experience?
I mean, no, we did a lot of research, actually, because we both lived the same era, right? We both lived the 80s and on. But, you know, before that, the 70s, the 60s, I mean, the 50s were tremendous years in Montreal. Mm-hmm. So not only were we getting information from people, from older wrestlers who lived that era, but we also did a lot of research in the newspapers of the time, and even going back to the early 1900s, that you know, I was amazed to see that, you know, wrestling was talked about in one of the biggest Montreal newspapers of the time almost every day from 1900 to 1920. So we did a lot of that, a lot of cross-checking informations with what we were being told and what actually was really going on, you know, by the newspapers, you know. So we did a lot of that as well. We didn't watch that many tapes because there's not a lot available, actually, from the Montreal territory. Mm-hmm. And the one that we have the most are the ones that we actually lived. It's in the 80s. So that was primarily our base of information.
And what we learn is that your memory is one thing. The actual timeline that newspaper will provide or an old archive footage will provide will say, oops, you know, I had my my timeline was mixed in my memory. So going back there, once we learned that, you know, it was always a process of getting the information, putting it together, and then making sure it really happened in that time frame.
You don't know how many times we actually got the same story from two different wrestlers, and it was like if it was two different stories. It was funny to a point, because that was one of the tough job to do, because we needed to actually find out what really went on, because you know, when you have almost two different stories, well, you need to talk to a third person, or you need to do other kind of verifications, so we can actually tell the right one. Memory is one thing, but there's nothing like doing the research and finding results and finding, you know, newspapers, clips or stuff like that, old programs, magazines that will tell you on a more precise way, you know, what you need to find, the information you need to find.
I really liked the organization of this book. It's broken out, of course, into historical chapters. There's wrestler profiles, rankings and listings. In a way, this book reads like a reference manual. Bertrand, was that kind of the intent?
You know, the version you have now is, I don't know, number 7 or something. So it was not the original intent, as the top 25 wrestlers in the history of the province was more the focus and the way things were built originally. And then, you know, we moved into different direction. We tried different format, and we finally locked on that one, trying to mix by era, you know, the big story of the era with the big stars of that got their start in that era as well. And I think, you know, the result, you know, speak for the work we put into it and reshaping the book quite a few times along the way.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the strong point of the book, is that you can start the book wherever you want.
Yes.
And still going back to the first page and read it from top to bottom. So that was one. I think that's a strong point in the book, because you can read it both ways, and it's a great read either way. But it was important to us to have that kind of chronological order in the book as well, and not only just bios here and there, you know, and not really having them in a particular order.
Exactly, because when I was reading the book, I felt like I was reading almost a fiction story, you know, one filled with twists and turns and drama. I mean, the Montreal Screwjob that we know with Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels is just one of the many sensational stories in the book. What a fascinating city Montreal was in the history of wrestling. Pat, a history that goes back to the 19th century.
Exactly. I mean, in the late 1800s, wrestling was starting to take form in Montreal, and you know, it was the old form of wrestling, you know, catch as catch can and collar and elbow style that were, you know, the predecessors of what we know now as the pro wrestling. But I mean, like I said, the early 1900s, guys like Frank Gotch and George Akenschmidt wrestle in Montreal. The promoter in Montreal was a guy named George Kennedy, and the fascinating thing about him is that he was at the same time promoting wrestling, and he was also owning the Montreal Canadiens, the hockey club here in Montreal. He was actually the owner when they won their first Stanley Cup, just before getting into the National Hockey League. So I mean, that's a fascinating story that we found out, you know, while researching on it. And yeah, I mean, Montreal was, and even at that time, Montreal was considered as one of the biggest wrestling cities throughout North America, even in the early 1900s. And that's maybe one of the facts that amazed me the most, you know, while searching and while researching for this book.
In fact, in the introduction, you write, quote, Historically, Montreal was only behind New York, Tokyo, Mexico, and Chicago as far as ranking as one of the biggest cities for the sport, unquote. Bertrand, don't you think that's a statistic or a fact that may surprise a lot of readers?
Probably, because, you know, the thing is with Montreal, the territory itself has been pretty much dormant, if not in a coma, for the past 25 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And so for younger fans, and for even, you know, we find this while we sell the book here in the province, you know, a lot of fans have become fans in the past few years, and they have no ideas what happened here before. And I think that's one of the important point about putting the book together, is those stories are there right now. Those people who lived through those years are still with us, and that story needed to be, you know, presented and be preserved for history. That so much stuff happened here, and so many guys got their start here and mm-hmm. became big stars in different territories as well. And most of them all came back to be big drawing card here in Montreal itself at some point for maybe 6 months or a summer like Ronnie Garvin. But, you know, they all had an impact at different level in different territories. So I think it was a very interesting story for a lot of people. We ourselves, we knew a lot and we learned so much. So
Montreal is so associated now with the Montreal Screwjob for the younger generation. But I mean, at one point, Montreal in the 50s, let's take the 50s, during 5 years, 4 or 5 years in a row, Montreal drew the biggest crowd of every of those 4 or 5 years in North America. I mean, you know, the biggest crowd in North America was in Montreal for all of those 4 or 5 years in a row. It beat New York, it beat Chicago, it beat L.A., it beat St. Louis. I mean, in the 70s, the same thing happened for a few years as well. I mean, in 1972, 73, it was among one of the two was the biggest crowd in North America. The other one was the second one. So I mean, and even when WWF took over the territory, in the mid 90s, when WWF didn't draw well, you know, anywhere in North America, well, Montreal was different because they ran a local angle with Jacques Rougeau's retirement match.
Right.
And, you know, it made Montreal the biggest business WWF had at the time. So I mean, of course, you can always argue, you know, who was the best. And I mean, New York, Chicago are really, really strong market. And you can always argue, you know, for other cities as well. But I think, you know, if you do a top 10 list of cities, you know, historically, the biggest cities historically, Montreal has to be there. I don't care if you put it, you know, before or after St. Louis or LA or Chicago. That's not the point. But if you have to name 10 wrestling cities in the world, Montreal definitely has to be there.
What I found so interesting throughout this narrative is the common theme that you mentioned on page 17, where you write, Montreal fans know what they like and what they don't like, and it's the promoter's business to adjust their act accordingly and not vice versa. Pat, what makes Montreal fans so unique?
Well, I think that's the, first of all, the language. I mean, I will remember forever going to a WWE, I think it was a Raw taping or SmackDown, I think it was Raw, yeah, it was a Raw taping, and people will just catcalling Lita, but in French. And I remember watching the show after, and you got, you know, Jerry Lawler and whoever was with him, and they go, well, I don't know what they're saying, but I'm pretty sure that's not, you know, nice words. So I mean, this is really special. Montreal is a really really crowd. It's a vivid crowd. I mean, they will react really strongly to a lot of stuff. I mean, Montreal fans were used to do riots when Abdullah the Butcher and Eddie Creechman were here in the territory in the 60s and 70s. I mean, they were always on the edge of their seats and always reacting You know, and I'm not saying that it didn't happen in other cities, but in Montreal, they didn't care what, they just didn't care, I guess. I mean, they were doing whatever they wanted to do. They were reacting the way they wanted to do. I don't know how many times, and you know, I'm giving examples of the latest years so people can understand, the listeners can understand. I mean, I don't know how many times the Montreal crowd chanted, "Use True Bread." And to Ebner, to McMahon, to Shawn Michaels, and I guess that's maybe why Vince used that a lot in Montreal, because he knew people would react, but at the same time, that's exactly what we wanted to do. So, I mean, the crowd was always special, and even if you talk to some wrestlers, they will tell you that. I'm not even sure if we didn't have a chance to talk about it in the book, David, because you know we had too much content for the book. But did you know that when a guy pins the other and the referee goes 1-2 and then everybody chants 2? Well, this chant was actually started in Montreal. I mean, and that may be hard to believe, but it was my friends. I was with them. My friends started that whole two thing that people kind of picked up. So I mean, that's something really special about fans, wrestling fans in Montreal.
Well, I knew when I started reading this book, I was really going to enjoy it. You mentioned George Kennedy. The fact that he was promoting wrestling and also owned a hockey team, like, you can't even imagine that today.
Yeah, I know.
And then you get into the story about Ed the Strangler Lewis actually being involved in the first Montreal Screwjob. I mean, any city that's got more than one famous Screwjob, that's going to be a good story to read.
You got that right.
But as we move into the first golden age of Montreal wrestling, I wanted to ask you, Bertrand, you talk a lot, of course, about the living god of Quebec wrestling, unquote, Yvon Robert. What made Yvon so legendary?
You have to put yourself back in that time frame. At that point in time, with Maurice Richard, you know, he became like the dream for French Canadians. He became that goal to go beyond and be the best and succeed. You know, he was involved in tons of businesses. He was he was a French Canadian who made it. And at that point in time with Maurice Richard, they were the two, you know, most prominent with television and with the exposure their respective sports give them, were the only ones who had that window to be the hero of the people. And that's what they became. And, you know, wrestling, you know, and on a regular night, wrestling is always about the hero beating the bad guy or the invader. So it was just perfect. You know, it just created more of a legend because wrestling is, you know, you can control what happened. You know, you could control that Yvon Robert would beat everybody. So it just built on and built on. And, you know, to this day, their family are still close. So they were really, really tight, the Maurice Richard and Yvon Robert family. And, you know, it's too bad that because, you know, he died quite young, about now 40 years or so ago,
yeah.
He has not totally disappeared, but, you know, it's fading. You know, if Dino Bravo's memory is fading, imagine Yvon Robert's memory. So I think that's why the book is so important as well. You know, those people need to be remembered.
You have to also understand that there's always been a huge rivalry in every kind of level between the English people living in Quebec and the French people living in Quebec. And that goes back, you know, centuries ago. And it's a political war. It's a show business war. It's, you know, it's there everywhere. So wrestling was no different. And Yvon Robert was a French Canadian that people could cheer for, mm-hmm. at a time where they were looking for that kind of French speaking local heroes. So they really got a lot behind Yvonne Robert, you know, and it would be like in the States if there was a war between the Spanish people and the English people in some borders states, you know, and it was actually the same here. So guys like Maurice Richard, guys like Yvonne Robert, they became really like huge at a level that we probably will never see again, because it was at really that time period where the French Canadians in the province of Quebec were really, you know, they were, you know, starting to speak for themselves and to say, well, you know, yes, maybe we were conquered by England a few centuries ago, but we'll prove to people that, you know, we have the right to exist and we have the right to speak up and we have our own heroes. So I mean, it was just the time frame was just perfect for a guy like Yvonne Robert, and you know, at the same time, a few years after television arrive in Montreal, and that's when, you know, it became so much bigger.
Mm-hmm. As you move through the book again, you talk about how some people didn't draw all that well in Montreal. I was surprised to read Luthez not a great draw in Montreal, and yet Nature Boy Buddy Rogers did real well in Montreal. In fact, you said he was the best American draw before Hulk Hogan. Why was the Nature Boy able to be so successful in that territory?
I guess people were more into the spectacle than just wrestling, I guess. Luthez, the only time Luthez drew a lot was when he was wrestling Yvonne Robert.
Uh-huh.
But you know, it's tougher to actually answer this question because we didn't live the era. But I'd say, you know, to have spoken to a lot of older wrestlers, that I don't know, there was something in Buddy Rogers. He was maybe see as a more complete wrestler because he could not only wrestle, but he could talk. He had a lot of charisma and he really clicked with the crowd. I'm not saying Luthez didn't have all those tools. But for whatever reason in Montreal, it wasn't the same. And that being said, he was a very close friend to Eddie Quinn, and he won the championship here many times. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not knocking Luthez at all, but at the same time, the facts, you know, when we look at results and you look at crowds that, you know, the people that drew, well, Luthez didn't do that well in Montreal.
There is a great story in here about the controversy between Luthez and Edouard Carpentier over the NWA Heavyweight Championship, and I thought this was a good indicator of the importance that politics played and still plays in the history of professional wrestling. Would you agree?
Oh, of course. I think, you know, that was one hell of a political battle.
Yeah.
And it all goes back to, you know, business. You know, we often see it as fan as, you know, it was a good match. Wow, I remember that moment, or he won that championship, or, you know, it's very emotional for people inside. Especially sometime in that time period, it's often enough about money. And that story is about money. It's like, okay, well, you know, they suddenly realized that if Carpentier was working outside Montreal, well, they were losing money by letting him go that often to be the NWA champion. And it all turned out into that big mess of Carpentier actually winning, then getting it taken away. And all that, and it was all about, you know, I don't like that promoter, and I don't, you know, I want him back in my territory, and I don't care about whatever you guys do, but I want him back in. And the guy himself was lost in the middle of that promotional pull apart, because Carpentier was not all aware of everything that was going on, but, you know, he was the one in line to make maybe more money working some other dates as well, but he was never really in charge of his destiny in there. But it's a fascinating story, and like we were the Pat was the only last person to actually spoke with Carpentier before he died about wrestling. So it's and it goes back about, you know, if nobody had spoken to Carpentier about that particular story, which to this day was the first time he actually discussed it, you know, it would have been lost because everybody else was already dead. So it was very important to get that there, because it's a big controversy that was never really settled, and there were so many stories and so many things that getting the Carpentier input in there was, we were able to put together, I think, a pretty good portrait of the political struggle of wrestling in the 50s.
For whatever reason, Sam Machnick and Lutev didn't really want to talk about it or to get into details about it. But I would have loved to see Eddie Quinn in a non-kayfabe era where he could have, you know, probably tell us more about what went on, you know. Because now all the key players aren't with us anymore. So Carpentier was probably the last one that hasn't talked about it, and he didn't do that. He didn't know that much, but I mean, you see in this story that money was always a big factor in a lot of, you know, decisions that promoters were actually making, because you know, Eddie Quinn realized that Carpentier was, you know, that he was doing a lot more money when Carpentier was wrestling in Montreal than the cut he was having for being the promoter of the NWA champion. Because as the NWA champion, Carpentier, you know, like any others, would have needed to travel all over the States, all over Canada, you know, all over the world to a certain extent. So he realized quickly that he was making more money by having Carpentier at home than by sharing him, even if he had the cut on it. So that's one of the reasons also that Quinn just lost it at one point and just tried to find a way to get Carpentier's back. So the story always told us that, you know, Machnick and the NWA didn't really, you know, when Tez didn't go to Europe, that they didn't really want Carpentier there. But I think it was likewise for Quinn, who didn't want Carpentier as the NWA champion as well.
We all know about Vince McMahon and the promotional war with the WWF's expansion into the other territories. Montreal had promotional wars within its city itself between International and Grand Prix, and you did a great job detailing the history of that. For example, Paul Vachon, of course, who along with his brother Maurice formed a legendary tag team, he was put in charge of running Grand Prix, said there are three things you need to be successful: a TV show, a license from the Athletic Commission, and being able to hold shows at the Montreal Forum. Did he have that right?
Oh, well, I mean, that's a formula it was given by Vern Gagne, actually, who told him, you need to get the license, you need to get television, and you need to run the biggest arena. And that's exactly what Paul did. He struggled doing it, because the war was actually between All-Star Wrestling and Grand Prix, but All-Star Wrestling was running for a few years, for like about five years when Grand Prix started. And it's funny because we hear from Vince McMahon or Eric Bischoff nowadays, you know, about their Monday Night Wars. You will talk to one or the other, and they won't tell you the same story. They don't see the story the same way, right? And it's the same thing still 40 years after. When we spoke to Raymond Rougeau, he told us something like, that Grand Prix, you know, didn't last that long and wasn't so big, you know. And when you talk to Paul Vachon, he's going to tell you that Grand Prix just dominated All-Star Wrestling for 2 years in Montreal. So I mean, you know, and that's the beauty of it, you know, because 40 years later, they still don't agree, or they agree to disagree, you know. And but yeah, Montreal was, at that time, it was the second golden age of wrestling in Montreal, and it was just fantastic. And like I said earlier, the two biggest crowds ever in Montreal were held during that era in 1972 and 73, when All-Star Wrestling in 72 promoted a show at the Jarry Park Stadium, drawing 26,000 people. And the year after, in 73, Grand Prix. Because, you know, that was a war, right? So Grand Prix told themselves, well, you know, if All-Star can run the Jarry Park Stadium, we're going to run it too. And they did 29,000 people. They even beat the All-Star Wrestling attendance. So, I mean, you know, that was just another great era in Montreal.
Bertrand, I think your write-up on Stan Stasiak is a good example of what I really enjoyed about this book, because it's a fair, balanced look at these wrestlers. As you write, Stasiak is the only Quebecer to hold the WWE World title, but because of some of his personal problems, his legacy is a bit more complicated than that, right?
Yeah, and, you know, Stasiak, well, that's another guy that, you know, at first look, you don't think, you know, oh, well, that's a Quebecer. You know, it's not like the Rougeau, where the name is a dead giveaway, you know. But he got that shot to be the WWF champion because he was such a, you know, he was the guy that they decided to use to be the bridge between two champions, like they often did in WWF. But they used him because he was, you know, believable worker and believable enough to pull it off, but they would probably not have considered him to be a guy for any long-term business because he had his demons and his problems, which we kind of discussed, and that also would like influence a guy like Rick Martel, who would see Stan Stasiak at the end of his career in Portland and would say to himself, you know, I cannot become him, you know, I have to find a way for after wrestling to have a business and to be a, you know, well off without having to resort to being a referee, a broken down referee in a small territory to try to make a living. And, you know, he's a typical wrestler from that time period as well. You know, he got that big break once, was everywhere and anywhere, but was never that big except for that moment where he was the WWF champion.
He was at the right place at the right time. And I mean, still, you know, he like his son said, you know, my dad didn't care if he was champion for 9 days or 9 years, you know, but he can say that he was the WWF champion at some point of his career.
Now, Andre the Giant, of course, was famous everywhere he went. He's just a massive star in the business. Pat, can you explain kind of his impact on Montreal specifically?
Well, his impact was—he wasn't here for a long time period. He was here at the beginning of the 70s, but because he could speak French, like the Carpazzi, like Henri Deglan, and like so many other Frenchmen, you really click with the crowd here, because the crowd here will cheer a lot more for a local guy or for someone that actually can speak French. And the Giant was such a great attraction. And I think he was adopted by the Montreal fans afterward, because they knew, I guess, that it was, you know, coming here in North America, and Montreal was the first city actually wrestled in. And from then, you know, they were kind of proud that, you know, well, that's our Giant, you know. And he had also a different name than after that in the States, and he was Jean Ferry here, as he was after that Andre the Giant. So yeah, he really had a special relation with the Montreal fans.
And for those who don't know, who is Gino Brito, and how did he impact the territory?
Gino Brito was the son of a former promoter named Jack Britton. Jack Britton was the guy who actually started midget wrestling. And Gino Brito started as a wrestler for his dad, and he wrestled through, you know, the end of the 50s up until the 1980s. And he was also the one who started Dino Bravo into wrestling. And in the 80s, he was the promoter for international wrestling with the third golden age of wrestling in Montreal. So he was the promoter here with some other partners, Frank Valois and even the Giant at one point, from 1980 to 1987. So, I mean, he was also a huge, huge help for us because Gino is the kind of guy that can, you know, that could talk about Buddy Rogers and you know, what he learned from his dad in the 40s and the 50s. But he could also talk about Kevin Steen or El Generico because he still followed in the wrestling in the last decade. So you know, it was a really, really huge help for us, and that's why we asked him to do the foreword in our book.
Well, I have to tell you that Burrito's protege, Dino Bravo, of all the wrestlers you profiled, I found his history the most interesting because I remember his run in the WWF in the mid to late 80s, and honestly, I was not a huge fan of his work then. But the Bravo you described, a much better wrestler, and even more than that, a huge national icon.
Yes. I mean, Dino is one of the people that a lot of people who grew up on WWF from the 80s have no idea how much of a draw he was.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a big draw in Montreal in the 80s, that's without a doubt. With Johnny Rougeau and Yvon Robert and Edouard Carpentier, he's one of the four biggest draw ever in the province, period. End of discussion. But he was a draw also in the South, in California, in the AWA. He had a career before that strongman run in the WWF. And he was a much better wrestler as far as, you know, not a much better wrestler. He was using more stuff, or he was doing different style than what he did when he was in the WWF. And part of the reason he was maybe stuck in a little bit in that role of being the strong man and being the bad guy in the WWF is early on when they came in Montreal and they first used Dino as the Canadian WWF Canadian champion, they kind of got cold feet about it and were like worried that Dino was going to turn out into a big baby face that could shadow Hogan, especially in Montreal when they were running shows. So I think he was put in that role to be effective because of his strength, which was a shoot, even though, you know, they pushed it over the limit. But to be in that role, to make sure that, you know, his natural charisma and is the flying he could do and the wrestling he could do would not come in and overshadow anybody that they wanted in a different position than they wanted Dino.
Well, I had kind of a similar feeling about the Rougeaus as well. I mean, I respected their work in the WWF, but I had no idea that they and their entire family were such big stars in Montreal. I mean, really, Bertrand, are they the most famous, successful family from that territory?
I mean, I think, you know, you would have to say that they like the heart from the Montreal territories. They're multi-generational, and again, to this day, Jacques Rougeau's son are wrestling on his show, and it goes back to the great uncle that took in Johnny and brought him into the business. So the Rougeau name is known outside of just wrestling circle in the province of Montreal. Everybody knows that when you're speaking about wrestling, you're speaking about the Rougeau.
You recount the infamous fight between Dynamite Kid and Jacques Rougeau in great detail. Man, this was no joke, Pat. What a scary situation, huh?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, and these kind of thing must have happened a lot backstage. There's probably stories that you know, no one actually told, or, you know, stories that were, you know, even maybe worse than this one. But that was one of the situation that is the most talked about. And, you know, since it was, you know, the Rougeaus were involved in it, you know, we kind of felt that, you know, we needed to tell the story as well. And it shows another face of what is, you know, wrestling. You know, it's not only what is in the ring, but sometimes, like any other job, actually, sometimes, you know, things happened behind the scenes because, you know, nobody can actually get along with everybody. And you know, that was one of the situations that happened there. And it was important also for us because the version Dynamite actually told in this book is not really the one that happened. He tweaked the things, you know, to his advantage, and you know, wanted to make sure that the real story, and it's not because we're from Quebec and we take for the Rougeaus. It's really, you know, we talked to that many people that we knew that the story that we wrote is really what happened, and it was important also for us to get that story right.
Yeah, out there, and it was the first time that Ramon really opened up about it in details of what he remembered from it.
Mm-hmm.
And we were also able to get comments from Pat Patterson, who was at the scene, so for the first time. So that makes it an interesting piece.
Well, and of course, Hulk Hogan, so central to the WWF expansion, did spend a good deal of time in Montreal. In fact, loved the city, but like many other territories, this expansion from Vince McMahon caused great hardship for the regional promoters. And then once you started losing stars like Ronnie Garvin, Rick Martel, Dino Bravo, the Rougeaus, like we mentioned, just too much to overcome, right?
Well, yeah, like it happened in other territories
else.
As well.
Yeah.
Calgary, Minneapolis, the Mid-South. And with Montreal, it's probably the four territories that suffered the most from the national invasion of the WWF in the mid-80s. So, but people, you know, always talk about, you know, the Calgary with the Hearts and Jim Neidhart and Dynamite and the Bulldogs and Minneapolis because, you know, Hogan came from there and so many others. But Montreal, you know, lost all of their key players also at the same time. So Montreal was as affected as these territories when Vince went national. The only difference is that because they were having such a great relation with the people running the Montreal Forum, that before Vince could run the Montreal Forum by himself, the Montreal Forum kind of forced Vince to do joint shows with International Wrestling in the last months of 1985. So for like five or six shows, that the WWF, to be able to run the biggest arena in town, had to share his talent with International Wrestling, which you didn't see in the other territories they took over. So, I mean, that's another thing that Montreal was special about, and it was, you know, it was at that time.
Bertram, do you think that Vince kept guys like Rick Martel at the mid-card level because he was kind of quietly punishing or exerting some sort of dominance over guys he brought in from other territories? I mean, why not give Rick Martel a main event push?
I think at that period in time, you know, the big slots were already there. You know, Hogan was there, Savage was there. You know, there's just so many room at the top. I think, you know, we have a quote about Pat Patterson, you know, saying that Vince wanted to get those guys because they were going to run the territory and they needed those guys to make sure that they were going to be drawing well. I think they were always protected and always put in good position, but they were never like, you know, they never put everything behind them. And you know, I think it's kind of normal and it kind of followed through on their pattern. They usually go with an American, and at that point in time, you know, who can argue with Savage and Hogan being on top? So, you know, Martel was good friend with Hogan, was good friend with Piper.
Yeah.
He always had a good spot as far as the tag team division went, and after when he went model, he was always in good programs, and he was always giving TV time and all of that, so I don't think they never saw it as punishment. I just think, you know, the bigger the more players and the bigger the pound, you know, it's harder to rise on top and be the guy. But you know, I think, you know, we always have to go back to, for them it's a business. So if business wise it would have made sense to put Rick Martel as the world champion, it would have happened. Hogan and Savage were doing a pretty good job.
The other thing that the only thing we could say about Vince and the Montreal Workers is that he finally turned all them heels.
Hmm.
He turned Bravo, the Rougeaus, and Martel heels at one point in their career. Is there a relation to make with, you know, because they were so popular in Montreal? Maybe in the case of Bravo, I could say that was, maybe that was really done because of that. For Rougeau and Martel, maybe not. And I mean, I really don't think that, especially Rick Martel and Raymond Rougeau, they didn't care about not having a great, you know, a spot on top or something like this, because they made so much money, you know, working for Vince at that time, and they had a very good relation with Vince, actually. Rick and Raymond in particular, and you know, Vince kept Raymond for years after that as a commentator, and even at one point at the end of the 90s, Raymond stayed home for like 6 months and was still getting paid by Vince because they lost the TV in France, and before they could get another deal, he had to wait a few months and was still got paid by Vince because he was such a loyal player to Vince. So I really don't see that as a punishment of some sort.
Montreal essentially ended wrestling in 1987, the Montreal promotions. Why was Montreal, even though they lost some of their big stars to the WWF, why were they unable to replace them with new stars, to create new stars?
They didn't have television anymore. In 1984, WWF took over their television, so they were only shown on some regional TV station, I mean. And I mean, that was the and they didn't get... They lost all their stars. They lost their television as well, and they weren't able to create new stars. And that's one thing that Gino Brito told us, is that maybe I should have pushed a few young guys earlier. But at the same time, you know, he could really never know when exactly Bravo or Martel or the Rougeaus would leave. So would you really replace them on top, you know, with a young kid when they were still around? You know, probably not. So it was a struggle for Gino at the time, and after Vince came, well, you know, Gino just, I mean, the promotion was just went bankrupt, and by that time, you know, no other stars was created, and there was no more television. So. And you need television to create stars. It's as simple as this.
But it's interesting that the WWF/WWE never really drew that well in Montreal then, and started running fewer and fewer shows, and then boom, we get the 1997 Survivor Series. Here we are almost 16 years later. It still feels fresh, interesting, and amazing. How important is Bret versus Shawn to the history of professional wrestling?
Well, the match itself is one of the most important match, probably with Andre and Hogan at WrestleMania 3 of the modern era.
Uh-huh.
Montreal will be associated with that for the rest, you know, of our lives, and that's a good thing, you know, because at least, you know, even if Montreal is not the territory it used to be, it's still linked to wrestling for the younger generation because of that match.
Sure.
I mean, nobody could have known at the time that match would create what it actually became. You know, it was you couldn't know at the time that it would be something big, but not as big as it actually became. And because, you know, and that whole Attitude Era kind of started with that Vince, the Mr. McMahon character, and all that stuff started with the match. So, I mean, it was an important match, not for Montreal, but it was an important match for wrestling, and it happened in Montreal. But, you know, if you talk to people in Montreal from, you know, on a local standpoint, and you ask them what is the most important match in territory, that wasn't the match, because it did nothing for the territory itself, but it did so much for wrestling.
Listen, guys, I'm going to have to run. I'll let Pat finish.
Okay.
Is that good?
Thank you so much. Pat, what do you think Chris Benoit's legacy should be? I mean, he's the only WWE WCW world champion to come from Quebec.
Well, I mean, it was important for us to talk about Chris Benoit because even though, you know, all that happened in 2007, we still wanted to talk about his wrestling career because, you know, I don't think that a very bad weekend should have made us not talk about the great wrestling career of Chris Benoit. I mean, he was probably the most talented worker in the history of the province. And that's another thing, is that Chris Benoit is usually talk about Chris Benoit, you'll say he's from Edmonton, he's from Alberta. But he actually was born in Montreal, in LaSalle more precisely, and he lived here for like 10, 12 years. I mean, he wasn't here on a fly, you know, and stay here for a year or two. He was here for all of his childhood. So it was important to us to not talk that much about what happened, you know, at the end of his life, but more about his wrestling career, because he had such a great one that, you know, we didn't want to do like WWE did and just erase it from history. Mm-hmm. It's a very sad thing that happened. I think with time, you know, we see things differently now than when it happened almost 6 years ago. But we didn't want to put our focus on what happened at the end, but more on his wrestling career. That's just what we did.
Fair enough. You devote a chapter in your book to the rich history of women's wrestling in Quebec. I wanted to ask you, is recent WWE Diva Maryse a big star in Montreal? I mean, she was the WWE Divas champion, and do they like the current Divas product?
Well, your first question, the answer is no. She probably did. Maybe she was probably talked about one time, maybe two, in a Montreal newspaper. And it's not necessarily her fault. It's just that, you know, WWE is not in French anymore in Quebec. WWE is on the Score in Canada, which is not a TV station that most people here get. You know, you need to take, you know, that package, you know, with some sports TV station. It's not everyone who can actually watch it like it was maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when it was on TSN, which is the French ESPN. English Canada version of ESPN. She is not that known in Montreal, actually. But the current Diva product, I don't know. I mean, it is what it is, you know, and probably that the Montreal fans think of it like any other wrestling fans, you know. It's sad that WWE is not looking, well, maybe that will change, you know, but they are not looking for the best female wrestlers. They are looking for the best looking female who could actually, you know, could actually wrestle a bit. You know, I'm a huge female wrestling fan, you know. We have a promotion here in Montreal named Femme Fatale, and it's my friends Lufisto and Stéphane Brière who actually run this company. And, you know, I go with them all the time to see the Shimmer shows in Berwyn, and I see, you know, I've seen so many great female wrestling matches that, you know, I'm always disappointed when I see, you know, what I see now in the WWE. And it wasn't always like that. I mean, Lita, Trish Stratus, even if Trish wasn't a wrestler to begin with, she really worked hard and became a good wrestler at the end of her career. Lita as well. But now I kind of feel that, you know, they're not looking, it's just an attraction. They're just there to have a female presence on the show. And besides a few girls that can actually wrestle, but they're not even using them as good wrestlers. I mean, Natalia is one of the best wrestlers they've got. Beth Phoenix was as well. And they always are able to turn that into comedy or into some other, you know, bad business that, you know, it's not even, they have good wrestlers, but they don't even use it as such. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I'm not the biggest fan of the Diva product.
Well, anyone who knows me knows I'm one of Beth Phoenix's biggest fans in the whole world. And last year at WrestleMania, she got pinned by a TV host. So, it was just horrifying. But, you know, there's great chapters in this book about the midget wrestling, the history of midget wrestling, the impact of the indie scene on today's wrestling. I wanted to ask you, though, given some of the talent in the indies right now, do you think there are some future stars getting ready for WWE or TNA? Who do you really like working in the indies today?
Well, one of them actually signed with WWE a few months ago, El Generico.
Yeah.
Who's now down in Tampa working for NXT. I mean, you know, I've watched this guy from its early beginning. I've watched his second match ever, and I was there when the El Generico character actually started. I was at that show when the first time he used it. I mean, so I followed his career for so many years, and I was really glad when he actually got signed. Another guy that, I mean, you know, they were always together is Kevin Steen. I believe that Kevin Steen, well, I really hope that Kevin Steen will be the next one signing WWE or maybe TNA. This guy has so much talent, and I mean, he's the king of the indies for almost 2 years now, and I really hope that the next step will be a place in Tampa or something like that. Alex Silva, talking about TNA. Alex Silva is a young kid that I've seen wrestle here in Montreal as he was 14 years old. And now, you know, he signed with TNA. They didn't give him much chance to wrestle there, actually. He mostly wrestled for OVW. But he's so young. He's 22 or 23 years old. So he's learning, and I'm pretty sure that's a guy you'll see years from now. And maybe another one would be, we would just talk about her, Lufisto. Maybe she's a bit older than Steen or Generico, but, you know, she has a lot of desires. She really has fire in her eyes, and she is, you know, probably one of the most talented female wrestler, you know, ever in Canada, I would say, not only Montreal, but in the whole country. And you know, maybe things won't work out. I don't know. Maybe it will, you know, with promotion like WWE or TNA. But, you know, she actually went two times this month to Mexico. So you never know what's going to happen. You know, maybe she'll be able to, because, I mean, there's not always, people talk a lot about WWE or TNA, but, I mean, you know, some other guys can have, or girls, can have great careers in Japan or Mexico, even though it's not what it used to be. It's still something to be proud of, and can actually live from you know, wrestling in those countries. Mm-hmm. So, and that's maybe a way that Lufisto will take within the next months or years, you know. So, but I would say that these four individuals are probably the most talented prospects that the Quebec territory, you know, have right now.
Now, your co-author, Bertrand Hébert, had to leave the call here a few minutes ago. I did want to congratulate both of you on a really wonderful book, Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screwjobs, The Untold Story of How Montreal Shaped the World of Wrestling. By the way, I noticed some photos in the book were taken at the yearly Cauliflower Alley Club reunion. Do you attend that reunion every year?
I started last year. It was my first time last year. And, yeah, we actually, there's one of the picture that was taken there, a great picture between Stone Cold Steve Austin and Paul Vachon, and it's so funny because they just look alike. It's really, really funny. And I'm going to be there this year as well, selling the book, actually. at the CAC. It's going to be my second time, and looking forward to meet all kind of great people over there as well.
Well, I do the radio show for CAC and do some media work for them, so I go to the reunion every year. I look forward to meeting you.
Oh, well, definitely. And I mean, you were talking about the pitchers, and I mean, that's one thing that I want people to know is that we have over 200 pitchers in this great book, and it's really, I think, a strong point, you know. And I mean, we have some people telling us that just for the pictures, it's worth every penny of the $20 you'll spend for the book. So, so looking forward to talk to you in Vegas.
Well, I really commend you both on a book that's filled with great research, interesting stories. It's a very enjoyable read. And before we let you go, I wanted to know, do you guys use social media? Do you have a website, a Twitter, a Facebook, any way that your fans, you know, people that enjoy the book can get a hold of you?
What is it? What is Twitter? I don't know what it's Twitter. No, I'm just kidding. Of course, we are big on social medias. We have a Facebook page at Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screwjobs. You can find both me and Bertrand on Facebook and Twitter as well. Pat Laprade, Laprade, and Bertrand Hébert. You can also visit our website at www.quebecwrestling.ca. On this website, you'll find a lot of information on the indie scene. The Quebec Wrestling Hall of Fame is in there as well, with every biographies of every guy or girl who are inducted in the Hall of Fame, and plenty other informations. If you'd like to take a look at the book, you can go on Amazon.ca for the Canadian folks, Amazon.com, or any kind of Amazons, as a matter of fact. You'll find it as well in your local bookstores. And me and Bertrand will be doing quite a tour in the States, actually. We'll be doing we'll be selling the book at the WrestleCon on Mania weekend. I'll be at the CAC the week after. We'll be in the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame in Jonestown, which was formerly Amsterdam, New York. We'll be at the New England Hall of Fame as well in Fairhaven, Mass. We'll be in Waterloo, Iowa for the National Wrestling, the Tragus and Tez Hall of Fame. And we'll be as well in the at the Mid-Atlantic Legends Reunion in Charlotte, North Carolina in August. So, I mean, if you check our Facebook page, you'll have all the dates where we're going to be there. You can come and, you know, take a look at the book, have a chat with us. It'll be our pleasure to meet all of you.
I'm looking forward to the New England Hall of Fame as well, because my friend is the selectman of Fairhaven, Massachusetts, a pretty small town.
The lineup is pretty stacked, actually, and we're going to have a guest vendor at our booth, and we just talked about him, is Paul the Butcher Vachon.
Nice, very
so,
good.
So Paul will be there with us to sign books and sell his own merchandise as well.
Well, Mr. Laprade, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. It was really an honor to speak with you and, of course, your co-author, Mr. Hébert. Congratulations on a great publication, Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screwjobs, The Untold Story of How Montreal Shaped the World of Wrestling. I could not have enjoyed the book more.
Well, thank you very much, David, for having us, and looking forward to meet with you in Vegas.
Best wishes to you.
Thanks.
And don't forget to check out the OWW website at onlineworldofwrestling.com. for the latest news, analysis, and updates from the world of professional wrestling. While you're there, you can also catch up on past episodes of OWW Radio. You can email us at radio@onlineworldofwrestling.com to submit topics or questions you would like us to discuss on an upcoming broadcast. Also, make sure to follow us on Twitter at OWWCOM to get all program updates and announcements. We'll also be posting directly to the official OWW Facebook homepage. Until next time, I am David. Thank you again to Pat Laprade and Bertrand Hébert for today's interview. The book, again, is Mad Dogs, Midgets, and Screwjobs, The Untold Story of How Montreal Shaped the World of Wrestling. Head over to Amazon.com to order a copy. Check out their website, www.quebecwrestling.ca. We hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll be back soon with another edition of OWW Radio.
right, well, that's okay.